Okay, we're recording. So, why don't you introduce yourself first?
My name is Frank Cummings, Frank E. Cummings III.
And you're an artist.
Yes, I'm an artist. And in fact, I'm an artist full-time now, and have been for the last 10 years or so.
So you have an exhibition here at the Long Beach Museum of Art. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to be?
About 4 years ago, I think it was 2010, 2011, I had kind of decided that I had done everything that I could do and had actually decided to maybe close down the studio and, who knows, do something different. But that wasn't the case. I woke up one morning and just felt it's time to go to work. And I knew exactly what I wanted to do, because I had been thinking about another clock off and on. It's part of the creative process. Most people think that the creative process starts when you sit down and you start sharpening your pencils or mixing the paints or sharpening your tools. But it's an ongoing, continuing, and changing process. This clock was a pivotal piece in my career, at least the clock before this one. It's called It's About Time. It's in the Boston Museum now. And there were things about the clock. About that piece. There's more things about that piece than the fact that it's a clock. The fact that it's a clock is kind of incidental. The statement that the clock makes was far more important. And once that clock was finished, it sat in my living room and I enjoyed it, winding it periodically. I would go downstairs and just listen to it at night. But then when the Boston Museum called and said that they were interested, the juices got going again. Primarily because whenever I send a piece out, it has to be what I call show ready. And that clock was 10 years old. And in my opinion, it wasn't show ready. There were some issues and problems with it. Things like the bushings, which is the part that holds the pinion, were placed in holes in the clock. And the one of them in the back, there's like 46 or 47 of them. And one of them in the back had a small crack in it. And I thought, I'd been watching that crack for a long time, and it stopped and hadn't moved. I figured, well, it's probably not going to go any further. But if I'm going to have it in an exhibition, especially in a place like the Boston Museum, I should get rid of that. And also, the clock ran for 54 hours before it had to be wound. And one of the criticisms, and I'm happy to say there weren't that many criticisms, but one of the criticisms, primarily from clockmakers, was that it didn't run long enough. People who collect clocks try to make clocks that run for much longer periods. So I thought, well, I could actually, if I'm going to take this clock apart and fix that one crack, I might as well go through it and make some changes so that it will run longer. So I took it apart, which was kind of scary, because I remember prior to that, I took it apart one afternoon, and I took a deep breath and closed my eyes, and when I opened up and looked at the clock, I couldn't put it back together. It was like, I've never seen this before. How am I going to do this? But after a few hours, a switch was flipped, and it was clear. So I didn't want that to happen again. But anyway, so I took it apart. I changed it so that it now runs for a week. I had to make some major changes. For example, I had to add a pulley. And the pulley had to look like the rest of it. But as hard as I worked, I could not make a pulley that looked like the rest of it. And the reason was that pulley was made 10 years ago. My skills, my thoughts, everything has evolved. But there it was. It was in the museum. They loved it. They actually purchased it for the permanent collection. So thinking about that, thinking about how I felt when it was finally finished, was an exhilarating moment. And it was only about a moment, because once it's done, then you move on. I wanted to do that again. But most of all, there were things that I had learned about that piece that if I do it again, it would be much better. And those kind of thoughts have been going on for a long time. But I woke up one morning and thought, well, it's time to go to work. Most of the materials were already in the studio, except for the gems. But all of the wood that I wanted to use was there. It was also, all of my pieces are made up of primarily one wood. And then I add the gemstones and the gold. But this new idea involved many different woods combined, which is a much more complicated idea. So I went to work. And it was going pretty smoothly. And then I begin to think ahead. Okay, what are you going to do with this piece once it's done? And I thought, what I really want to do is have a solo exhibition with this new piece as the centerpiece. And the 20 or so vessels and pieces that I already had. And what I was doing back then, a lot of the work I did that was in the Lipton collection are what I call studies. If I had an idea to do a piece and I had not used that wood before, there were things I needed to learn about the materials and about how they related and about how the whole concept would fit together. So I do a study. A study usually resulted in a much smaller piece using the same materials and a general kind of concept. But what I was doing is trying to understand the wood, the materials, and this particular concept so that I could then do the piece. So when I did the piece, I decided to keep it. I made a box for it, put it in a box, and then put it away. And after that, I didn't think about it too much. One of the reasons that I was doing that is because most people who have seen my work actually have not seen the work, but they've seen a photograph of the work. And the reason for that was as a university professor, that whole publisher-perish concept played heavily into the arts as far as I was concerned. And my PhD colleagues wouldn't understand one of my vessels if I put it in front of them. They said, oh, that's interesting. What is it? But if that same vessel appeared in a publication, they said, oh, well, let's take a look at this. The written word is far more impressive to those folks than the piece itself. So all the pieces were done. And before I let them go, I worked really, really hard to get them into a publication. The other thing that happens is, on the very few pieces that I've ever sold, was based on somebody seeing the photograph. I've had people come and say, oh, I saw this book and they had a piece, and they describe it. Can you do one of those for us? I'm sorry, but I can't do that. But I thought, if I could ever get to the point where somebody came and said, I saw a publication, can we get one like that? I says, how about this one right here? So I decided to keep them until after I got them into publication, and then figure out what I was going to do with them next. But shortly after I started doing that, I retired from teaching. Primarily the stress, especially the administrative part, was too much. And so I started accumulating my own work. I used to say, I'll do a practice piece, and then I'll do what I call a killer piece. And then that piece goes away until it goes into a publication where I'm more likely to be able to get the amount that I feel it's worth, as opposed to selling it early. So I ended up amassing these 20 or so pieces. And immediately I thought, it's time to show them. I said, what would happen if I showed them all at one time? And most of which people have not seen before. Many of them. In fact, most of them have been published someplace or other. But I had this idea then now of this solo exhibition with the maids in waiting and then the queen. And I actually envisioned it just like this, with all of those pieces in one room and this piece in the room by itself. That's when I went. I came here to the museum to Ron and Sue Ann, and I said, I have an idea. And the most wonderful thing is that museums generally do not buy into ideas. They buy into finished work. They need to see it, understand it, and visualize how it's going to fit into their program. So for a museum to buy into an idea when the main piece was still parts and pieces and ideas and drawings was amazing. But they said, well, we like this. And I thought mainly, based on my track record, they might be willing to do it. When I say track record, the pieces and publications and pieces and other exhibitions and museums all across the country might be enough to convince them that I could pull this off. And to be honest, I wasn't sure I could, because this clock is far more complicated than the first one. Not only in terms of the mechanism, but in terms of combining such a large number of different pieces and different elements and make them all work as one. I thought I could pull it off, but I wasn't sure. So it was like a day-to-day process. As a result, I remember now doing several pieces which were part of this piece. A wheel or a pinion. And getting to the point where that piece was finished, and then looking at it, said, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. Sometimes it wouldn't work because of a technical issue I had with that piece. But often it wouldn't work because the materials that I was using for this piece made statements that were not compatible with pieces that were already done. They all had to work together. It was very much like a composer sitting down and writing a symphony. There are so many pieces that have to fit together. Different instruments, different musicians, all of whom have their own characteristics, but all of a sudden they all have to work together for this one composition. And that's what this became. Every piece had a role to play, and even though some of them were really fantastic, wonderful pieces, they weren't working with the other pieces. They were either too high, too low, too loud, too flamboyant, And some of them said, well, you need to play a little louder, which means you have to do that piece over again. When I say play a little louder, it means that the materials that I was using at the time were not standing out the way I thought they should be in that position. The wood wasn't dark enough, or the wood was too light, so it had to balance. And that's why it took so long to do this. 4 years later, you see it here. But it took 4 years to do that. And the interesting thing was, I was prepared to take as long as it would take. I had no idea it would take 4 years. Or, in fact, I thought maybe it would only take two. Because the first clock only took 1 year. And because this one's so much more complex, I thought, maybe two. I had no idea. But I don't put a time limit on my work. Once I start to work, I just keep working and working. Excuse me. Until it's finished. When I came to the museum with the idea, and they said, yes, we can do it, they put a date. Let's do it here. And I said, that sounds great. And has it been 15 minutes already?
Yes.
Whoa.
Okay. So you were saying that you were faced with this new time limit. Actually, yeah. Before you begin again, I want to do one thing, which I should have done to begin with. I'm going to silence my phone. Just in case.
Okay.
I'm not that popular. But. So you were saying you were faced with this new deadline.
Yes. All of a sudden I had a deadline and it was terrifying. I said, I've got to do all this work. And at this time, you still have no idea of how long it's going to take. You're still in that mode of, I'll just keep working and working until it's finally done. It has its time. And I'm sort of committed to that time. But now there's a deadline. And so the work became much more feverish. I'd wake up earlier than I normally would. Well, when I say normally would, the piece wakes me up. In fact, when I go to sleep, I don't really sleep sound because I'm solving problems, resolving issues while I'm sleeping, and I'm much more efficient when I'm sleeping than when I'm awake. Because I will wake up and say, ah, got it. And I used to try to write it down, but because when you wake up like that, you're sort of still in a fog. I had to write stuff down. I couldn't understand what I wrote. I even tried tape recording it. That was worse. So when I wake up and I says, I've got it, I have to get into the studio immediately and implement what happened. That went on for a total of 4 years. And I learned a lot too. Usually people would think, well, you have all this stuff in your head, it's all resolved, and you just go ahead and do it. No, it's like, it's resolving issues on the run. In fact, I wake up and go to work and an issue will present itself. I had no idea it was there. And before I can move on, I've got to resolve it. It may be a mechanical issue, which didn't happen that often. Mechanical issues were actually easier for me to resolve than, say, conceptual ones. Because mechanical ones, all the pieces are right there. And you can move them around or change them until they finally physically work. The conceptual issues are much more difficult. I'll reach an impasse, and for a day or so, I don't know what I'm going to do next. So at that point, I will switch to another part. Mm. I kind of knew what it was going to look like when it's done. But there was a time when I said, well, there's an issue with the mechanism, so I'll work on the base. In fact, I said, once I get the base done and the cabinet done so that I can actually see it, it'll start to become more real. Because as long as it's in your head, it isn't real at all. Even when you jot it down or sketch it down on paper, it's still not real. It's not real until you actually pick up the materials, manipulate them, and finish the piece. And when I say finish the piece, I mean polished and everything, and that piece works. Then it's done and you can move on. Because every piece that you do, at what I call the lower end of the piece, has a direct effect on every piece beyond that. So it's so complicated that I can't hardly describe it. In fact, I heard that some clockmakers came to this exhibition. I wasn't here at the time, but when they went downstairs, or before they came up, they mentioned to the kids downstairs that they're not serious clockmakers, they just dabble. And I thought, there's no such thing as dabbling in clockmaking. You either do it or you don't do it. There's no in between. But this piece evolved and it grew. And there are things that happened that I couldn't resolve at the time. For example, the weights of the previous piece fit right between that upright. And I always take the weights off first because they're so heavy and they're putting so much stress on the piece that removing them first makes it easier to take everything else out. But I did not know how much weight it would take to drive this clock. I knew what the weights looked like because I'd already selected the wood for that. But as I got to the point where I could sort of determine the weight, I realized that the weight would be more than it took to do the previous one. One of the reasons is because this one was designed to run for a week or more. Whereas the first one, 54 hours, actually 1 hour, was wonderful for me. Even more. The first tick-tock, I was happy as I could be. But it ran for 54 hours, and I had to revise it so it ran for a week, which means you had to put more weight in. I had to go through the entire piece and relieve as much friction as possible. Friction is the problem with clockmaking. The more you reduce the friction, the less weight there is to drive it, and the longer the clock will last. But this one took more, so I made the weights and put them in. It was working fine. But because the weights were larger than the previous ones, they wouldn't fit through those uprights. So the only way to take the weight off is to remove the glass. That was not part of the original concept. That just made it much more complex. Just putting it together and taking it apart became another huge issue. And once you're far enough into this kind of a process, you can't go back. You can't go, oh, well, these two pieces should be farther apart. Well, there's no room to make them further apart. They are what they are, so you have to work around those pieces. So it's like a building block. Or like you build a foundation first. And then if you build a foundation that will support a single-story house, but in your mind this house grows into a two- or three-story house, how do you go back to change the foundation to support the weight? You have to know that before you start. And for most of this piece, I didn't know things until I got there. And then it's, oh my gosh, now what do I do? That's one of the reasons it took so long to do it. But here it is now in this facility, in this gallery. And people may not understand this, but when I walked in here and we installed the show, and I took a breath and stepped back, I saw it for the first time. I've never seen all of this work out at the same time. Even though I've had it for years, once they go into the box, I rarely take them out. because I'm moving on. So to see them in this gallery for the first time was a real eye-opener. I saw continuities in the work that I kind of thought they were there, but I'd never seen them. And so when you actually see them, it's very, very different when they're out here as opposed to when they're in here. So I spent a lot of time just walking through this gallery when no one was here, of course, just looking at them. Wow. There are a couple pieces I looked at. I knew they were really great pieces, but I look at them now and think, whoa, they are really great pieces. This piece works so much better than I thought it would when it's in this environment, because in reality, this entire exhibition is connected. Not just because I did it, but because there's a thread of connection that runs through all these pieces because of the concepts that I had originally. Small ones, like, this piece that's closer to the door, actually the one next to it, is the one that's made of a really wonderful walnut. It's a burrow walnut. And you don't normally see that kind of wood unless it's on the dashboard of a high-end car. And even then, it's paper thin. And in that piece, there are genuine diamonds and opals and 18-karat gold. When I started that piece, or actually before I started that piece, I knew exactly what it was going to look like. I knew exactly what I wanted it to say. Every one of these pieces has its own voice. And each one has a statement and a story. And the stories are all connected. This one that I just described is called Cece with Diamonds. And Cece is my wife. Cece and I have been married now for 50 years. And celebrated our 50th anniversary last October. And she's been an inspiration for most of the work, one aspect of her or another. For example, the piece on the Fox Inn, Cece and her sister went to Las Vegas. And I guess they went to, I think it was like Caesars or something like that. And in that facility, you can have your photograph taken in costume. And so they both dressed up like Cleopatra. And when they came back, I saw the pictures. Her sister had a big smile on her face and was excited about being dressed up like Cleopatra. And Cece was more solemn. Even if you saw the photograph, it's hard to describe her demeanor and the expression on her face. But one day I asked her about it. And she said, well, as soon as she put the costume on, she realized that she's not a descendant of Cleopatra, like a lot of them feel they are. That she didn't belong there. She said, if she's a descendant or reincarnate of an Egyptian person, it came much, much earlier than Cleopatra. She said, if any of them, I probably would feel better dressed as Nefertiti. And right then it stuck in my head. I've got to do that. And so that piece has sort of an Egyptian quality in that the top part is more like a large fan. And there's lots of gems. There's pearls, there are diamonds, and a large topaz with 18-karat gold around it. And its title is Sisi, aka Nefertiti. So you have that piece, in fact, that's one of the first pieces you see on the far end there. And the piece in the same showcase is a piece that I did based on my experience the first time I went to Africa. I went there to learn. I wanted to know more about fetishes. What is a fetish? How does one make it? And more important, how does one endow it with special powers? Because I was in an exhibition back in 72, and the reporter who covered that wrote in a magazine that Cummings is influenced by the Native American and African culture, which was news to me, and is making true fetishes. I had to look up the word fetish to figure out what they had said I had done. And I thought, this isn't right. But once something is in print, it becomes true. People respond to that as though it were true, and you can't change it. Even if they write a rebuttal, nobody reads rebuttals. First of all, you can't even find them if they write them. And so people started looking at my work as being fetishes. And so I decided, well, I need to figure out what this is about. And at that time, in my studies in art history, I'd run across an Ashanti stool, which at that time I saw as a piece of furniture. And this form, it was a fertility piece called an Akuwaba. And so I decided to go to Ghana, specifically to Ghana, and my goal was to find these Ashanti carvers.
I'm going to stop you there for one second. Stop this. So you went to Ghana to find Ashanti carvers.
Yes. And find out, how do they make these things? One of the things that I was curious about is most forms or figures from Africa, from those cultures, are made from a single piece of wood. And some of them are quite large. And there are some that I have found that, with their so-called primitive techniques, which is another reason I went there, I needed to find a new definition for primitive, because it didn't make any sense to me. These people are using so-called primitive techniques and making these pieces that in many cases we cannot duplicate with our so-called sophisticated tools. So we need to find a new word for that. So I went there and spent a great deal of time with one Ashanti carver. And I spent a lot of time with fetish priests, because there's a connection there. And when I came back, I decided to do a tribute to John, who was the carver I spent the time with, by doing my version of the Akuwaba, which is that. But you'll notice that an Akuwaba is a child. In Ghana, the mortality rate for children is extremely high. And childbirth is quite low, or successful childbirth is quite low. So these dolls were designed and commissioned by a fetish priest. A carver would make them. The fetish priest would then give one of these dolls, or babies, to a woman who wanted to have children. And she was told to prove her worth as a mother first. So she would carry this doll and take care of it, clothe it, and have it with her all the time until she proved her worth as a mother. And then the gods would grant her the wish. That actually makes a lot of sense. But anyway, so I did this piece, but if you look at it, the torso part obviously is not a child. It's a full-blown female. The model for that was Cece. It has characteristics and attributes that Cece says, that's not me. In my head, it was. So you have Cece appearing in more than half of the work that's in this gallery. The piece that Bonnie had that's called Resplendent. And if you look up the definition, there are several versions of splendid, and most of them are feminine terms. There's one that's called caress, or not caress, but embrace. And it, the material is manipulated in such a way as though it appears, actually doesn't appear, it actually does embrace other parts. So there are two separate parts and one is embraced by the other. But the embrace that I'm talking about is only symbolized in that piece, but it's realized in an embrace with Cece. There's one called Passion Fire. There's one called Allure. All of them are about Cece. So in reality, what you see here in this gallery, including this piece, is a love story. It starts in the front with a hall tree, which is actually a love seat. It's big enough for two. And it is, it's an anatomical study of the human form with the addition of the strength and agility that I saw in a gazelle. So they're all kind of mushed together there. But if you look at it carefully, you can see it. And then as you come through and you look at the pieces, you'll see different aspects of our relationship throughout this whole gallery, except for two pieces. And those two about me specifically. Cece's not involved in it. Those are the only two pieces, let me think. Those are the only two pieces that Cece is not visible in any form or any format. The carousel is about me when I was very young, 4 or 5, I guess it was, when I saw my first carousel. It was at Griffith Park in Los Angeles. My parents, had a family picnic there with other relatives, and they were playing games, baseball, and had a nice picnic. But there was no money to ride the carousel back in those days. So that was just my imagination. Sitting there, I spent hours there watching the carousel. And this carousel is the third carousel. It didn't start off to be a series, but it just evolved into the series. When I decided to do a carousel, I had no idea of how to go about doing that, which is a true statement about every piece I've done. In the beginning, I had no clue. It just evolved. But the first one is in the Lipton collection, and I just call it Carousel. It was my attempt at making a carousel. I wanted it to look like a carousel. No, I wanted it to feel like a carousel. And so there are carousel figures, and Dr. Lipton really loved it, and actually it got published also. But that was what I call the study. The second one is called Carousel Age of Innocence. It is about a child riding a carousel, perhaps for the first time. And at that moment, I remember what it was like when I rode one for the first time. And you almost naturally think of all of the fantasies of riding a carousel, or riding a horse, or whatever the figure might be. You could be the cowboy riding down to save the town from the bad guys. You could be the knight in shining armor, you know, riding his steed to slay the dragon. It could be all of those things. As long as you hold on to the pole and look forward, the fantasies will stay intact. That's what the second carousel is. All of the figures are what we call flyers. In other words, none of the feet touch the base. They're all in a flying position. And they're all looking forward. And they all have the spiral pole that goes through them. But what happens when you look to the side? When you look to the side, you realize that what you were thinking at the moment was a fantasy. It's not real. The real world is up there. Once that happens, you have two choices. You could either stop looking up and look ahead and play back into your fantasy, or you need to get off. So this carousel, they're not tied down by a pole. They're free. Some of them even have one foot up. And all of them are looking to the side. Which means they are free to step off the carousel into the real world. That the fantasy for them is over. Which is as it should be, because we can't live in fantasies. We have to live in the real world. And that's what this carousel is about. It's about the real world. And so it's called Carousel Age of Awareness. Once you're aware, now you have a choice to make. The other one that's in this gallery is about me is this piece right here on the end. For 40 some odd years now, which is how long I've been doing this, there has been a consistent question or issue in my work. It starts back, for example, in 1972, when they did that article. I had not met that person who wrote the article. I don't think they knew who I was. But they said that I was influenced by the African culture. Old letters. So what is it about my work that people assume that I am influenced by the African culture? Because at that time, I wasn't. I've also heard people would come up to me. In fact, a few weeks before this exhibition opened, there was another exhibition opened here, and I decided to go to the opening. And someone showed this couple a photograph of one of my pieces. And they looked at it and they admired it. And they said, well, would you like to meet him because he's here? And so they brought me over and introduced me to this couple. And they looked surprised. And it's a surprised look on people's faces that I've seen many, many times before. But the lady finally asked me, is your work, she said, I see it now. Your work, this piece, is influenced by the African culture. And I didn't get her that thought. No, it's not. And she was embarrassed. People assume because I'm African American. There was a time when I was a colored man. Then I was Negro. Then I was black. And now I'm African American. But people assume that an example. My father in 1948 was national model airplane champion. And the first prize for that championship was a real airplane. My father won a real airplane because he was national model airplane champion. But my father had to go to court to get the airplane, because they didn't want to give it to him. One of the criticisms was, what is a black man going to do with an airplane? So a lot of people are surprised when they see my work and then discover that I'm black. They do what I call a double take. Some of them stutter, some of them have, they don't know what to say. But the point is that for as long as I can remember, people have not quite understood what I do or what I've done, because for them it's sort of a paradox. You know, there's work in here that has been compared with Fabergé. And they can't understand how a primitive black man could do that. I've actually had a few people say that. So this piece right here is made of a really beautiful piece of ebony, but it's not black. If you look at it very carefully, there are streaks of other colors in this ebony. There's what I call brown, and there's coffee, there's mocha, there's even kind of a vanilla color in there, which hopefully suggests that black is not necessarily a color, it might be many colors. And there are many colors in that piece of wood. Stop for a second. The piece has a really large number of black pearls. But if you look at them, they're not black. There's some that are green, there's blues, there's purples, there's several other colors that are in a black diamond, but it's not black. The black diamonds in there are so dense that light doesn't come through them, but light reflects off of them. And so as you move around that piece and look at the diamonds, they appear to be different colors. And the reason is they are reflecting all the colors in this room, including you, as you move around. And so you might walk all the way around them and you will swear that none of them are the same color. So it's a piece that makes a statement about color. That perfect timing. Is it close to, is it 11 o'clock?
Yes.
Changing the subject a little bit. That chime was B flat. And people said, well, why B flat? Well, I can't tell you exactly why, but that particular note is something that I hear all the time. I hear it in the studio. If I drop a tool, I can hear it. If I'm outside, I can hear it in the sounds. Whenever there's music playing, and I play music all of the time in the studio, the B flat, for some reason, it makes me say, what? I hear it. it makes me think that, I guess I think I'm really, really lucky because I only hear one sound. But I can't imagine what a music composer hears when they can hear the entire symphony and they've got to get it all out and get it on paper and then transpose it. I'm lucky I only hear one. But that one to me is really, it's hard to describe how I feel about the note, but it's a very calming sound. It's a sound that makes me think that everything's good. Everything's going to be, or if it's not good, it's going to be okay. So I worked really hard to get that particular sound in this clock. So it's interesting because when this clock is at home and it's downstairs, you can barely hear it at night upstairs. But sometimes it wakes me up. And ever since this clock has been here, I will wake up and I thought, wait a minute, I heard it. Somehow I heard that clock, but it's not even there. It's here. But anyway, back to this piece. I've been to so many conferences now that I can't even remember how many. I do remember the ones that took place in Utah, Philadelphia, and Nebraska. Those I remember because something happened at each one of those places. Specifically, the one that was in Utah. The first time I went there, 70-something, early 70s, there was a conference of wood turners. And I say wood turners is because even though I use a lathe and I put wood on it, I am not a wood turner. Furniture is in here also. This piece is considered a furniture, but I am not a furniture maker. Oh, then you must be a clock maker. I have made clocks, but I'm not a clock maker. In fact, I was here, I've been talking to children a lot. They have a wonderful children's program at this museum, and I really enjoy talking to the kids. But I was standing here, and the clock was working, everything was fine. And they asked, do you have any questions for Mr. Cummings? And one little girl, I have a question. And she said, how long did you go to clock school before you learned how to do this? Oh my God, how am I going to answer this so that she understands? I said, I've never been to a clock school, but I know how to make a clock. And she couldn't quite understand, well, how could you do this but not go to school to learn how to do this? But anyway, off track here a little bit. Whenever I have done a conference for wood turners, furniture makers, or woodworkers, there's another group. There's craftsmen, woodworkers, furniture makers, wood turners. Oh, and jewelers. When I have done these conferences, my motive or my goal was to have yet another opportunity to show my work, and I would pick that particular arena. On a number of occasions, race became an issue. I didn't make it an issue, but somebody in the audience did. And in most of those cases, it's in a negative term. terms, and negative circumstances. And so I've had to deal with that. And some people, there's several kinds of, there's a form of racism that we see that is because they simply don't know. And that doesn't really bother me, because I have an opportunity to explain that issue. And then there is an issue, because it's just plain old bigotry. It's down deep in their bones. And to try to change that, you're wasting your time. You can't change it. But that does pop up now and then. And I have tried to explain to individuals where the work comes from, how I feel about it, and I try to do it in a context that they will understand. That hopefully by their understanding, it will make a difference and make a change. So I don't mind doing that. But it's a continuing process. So this piece is my, I almost want to say final statement, but I realize it's not my final statement because I'm gonna make it again. That's a great statement. With all of these colors in this one piece, and with all of these materials that people assume are black, but they're not, the statement for this piece is, can you see me now? Most people, I don't think, have figured that out yet. Because of when I do have people come through and they ask me questions, they ask me a lot of questions about a lot of pieces, but no one's ever asked me a question about. Or maybe it's a clear statement, and that's why you don't ask me. That's a possibility. I hadn't thought about that before. But the fact is, I've not seen these before, and it's hard to describe how I feel. But first of all, I'm very, very pleased with all of the work. It might sound arrogant, but I'm impressed by it. I said, whoa. There are pieces here that I don't remember doing. There are pieces of this piece right here that I don't remember doing. And I don't know why it happens, but I remember the first time it happened with a chair that I had just finished. And I was putting wax on it. And I was stooping down on the floor, waxing it. And you know, when you do that, you stop circulation in your legs and you start to tingle. And I think, God, I need to sit down. And so I sat down on the floor and I closed my eyes, took a deep breath, and I looked up at the chair, and it shocked me. Because at that moment, I had no idea where that piece came from. I had no memory of actually doing it. But then there's a little part that said, well, don't be stupid, of course you did it. But most of me said, I do not remember doing it. And that's pretty much true with every one of these pieces. I know I did them. I can even tell you about when I did them because I put a little note on the bottom. But the memory of actually doing this work is gone. For all of these pieces, especially this one, and that's the newest one. I should have that here, but it's not. So if I should do another one, I will, what I call, recreate it. I have notes, I have drawings. In fact, shortly after I finished the first clock, and understanding that a clock that ran for longer periods is more popular, I did all new drawings. And I did them much more accurately. And I did a whole series of them that gives me enough variety of different size wheels and gears that it's theoretically possible for me to do a clock that will run for 1 year. I'm not going to do that. I'll tell you right now, I'm not doing that. Just to do one that'll run for a year is a technical feat, but that's all it is. So I can't say I won't do another one, but I don't think I will.
There were two questions I really wanted to ask you. The first relates to the story you told about your father winning mm-hmm. the plane. The minute you started talking about that award he won, it made me wonder if his obvious love and passion for working in wood mm-hmm. influenced you in developing your passion about working in wood.
My father has influenced me in a lot of different ways. I can't say for sure that his passion for wood, because his airplanes were made of balsa wood and silk and tissue paper. But his, can't think of the word now, but his willingness to do whatever it took to create that model. Because there were no plans, and there were no kits back then. All from scratch from here. But his tenacity, his willingness to spend hours and hours and hours trying things, experimenting until he finally got it right, was a definite influence. My father was not a mechanic, but my father could take a car apart, fix it, put it back together, the entire engine. I watched him do it. He would start taking the engine apart, and he would put the pieces in a line in the driveway, line them up, until he got to the piece that needed to be replaced or repaired. He would repair it, replace it, start at the end of the line, and work back, and put the car back together again. My father was in construction. He was a laffer. Laffing is the sort of the particle board that goes on before the plaster. He was one of the best in the country at doing that, in terms of how fast he could do it. In those days, they didn't have nail guns. They had an axe, and the cutting edge would be what they cut the board with, and the other end is what they pound the nails in. But my father, in fact, Lathers at that time would get a handful of nails and pop them in their mouth, and these nails would come out, and he could pound it. And my father set up a rhythm, a consistent rhythm, but if you walked on the job site and stood there for a second and listened, you'd know exactly where my father was, because you could hear it. The steady, he was fast. He was really, really fast. And he was really, really good at what he did. So those kind of things, I've inherited from my father. The patience that it takes to do those kind of things, those are now mine. But I've inherited things from my other relatives, too.
I'm going to stop for 1 second. Inherited things from your other relatives.
My Uncle John was the chef on the Southern Pacific Railroad on what they call the VIP train. And he was a really good cook. But that was in the days when he was not allowed to come out of the kitchen on the train that ran from here back east. But my Uncle John, for me, was the storyteller of the family. I remember going to his house, which was fortunately bicycle riding distance from where I used to live, and spend hours and hours in his den while he told these stories about the family, about his life. He was an avid fisherman and hunter. And back in that day, they weren't sportsmen. They were meat hunters. I mean, they went hunting because of the food. And so all of those adventures and those stories, I remember sitting there on the floor listening to his stories. And not too long ago, a friend of mine, Bob McNeely, we were talking about something. And he looked at me and said, "You're now the storyteller." And he's sort of right, because every one of these pieces has a story. Nonverbal. Which is sometimes a little harder to get across, but I think I've been pretty successful at it. I've had really, really good responses from people who've seen this. Because they too are seeing this for the first time. They may see a picture in a book. I've been in literally hundreds of exhibitions where it was a group show and I had one piece there. But this is the third time I've done this. The first time happened to be here at this museum. Back in the early 70s, I had my first solo exhibition here. That was long before this building was even constructed. It was in the foyer and the what is now the dining room of the house next door. And I remember that. I remember how great it was, but it was different. It was different in that most of the work that was in that exhibition were studies. In a study, I learned how to use the materials, the tools that are associated with that material. Learning how to make what they call a bezel, which is the rounded part of the metal that a stone fits in. It takes a long time to learn. It takes a long time how to do a good one. It takes a long time to learn how far can you push the material before you've pushed it too far. The only way to learn that is to push it too far and then back up a little bit. But sometimes it takes years to do that. The finishes on my work have changed rather dramatically. There was a time when I was only concerned about the enhancement of the grain of the wood, which is primarily what finishes are. Enhancement and protection is what a wood finish is. And for a long time, that's all I was concerned about. I want to protect it, and I want to enhance it. But now, the idea of protection has gone a lot further, because I've learned that a lot of woods are affected by sunlight. Affected in that they change. Some of them get lighter and a lot of them get darker. When I start working with the wood, if I can hold the surface the way I see it at that time, that's what I'm going to do. So how do you keep it from changing? How do you make it so that in some cases, when the person comes up to it, they can see their face. That's sort of new. That goes way beyond protecting and finishing. The materials in my work have grown. And learning how to use them, using the materials, has been it's been a wonderful experience, but it's been very, very difficult, and sometimes it's very, very expensive. I like the idea of using materials that no one else had to manipulate and or influence before I get to use it. So when it comes to stones, for a while I was cutting my own stones. But I realized that's a career in itself. and a time-consuming one, and an expensive one too, and I don't want to be a stone cutter. All of the photographs that you've seen up until this catalog are photographs that I took. So I had to learn how to use the camera, because every photograph you've ever seen of my work is a photograph that I took. But it got to the point where, well, the technology began to change. I found a film that worked really, really well with my work, because although even some photographers don't believe it, that all of the work that you've seen that I took the photograph was taken in natural sunlight. Because in my opinion, natural sunlight gives you the best color possible. And there was a film made by Kodak years ago that was perfect for that. But it was a very, very slow film. I think the ASA of that film was down way under 100. It was really slow. So you had to use a tripod. You cannot use that film without a tripod. But the photographs were absolutely brilliant. Well, Kodak stopped making the film because the average person didn't use a tripod. And of course, when you take it holding your hand, it's fuzzy. And so I had to find new films. Then the big change came when all of a sudden there was a film. The process was called E6. And there was a processing house in Anaheim that I went. And I could take the wood, take pieces of the wood that I used to piece, give them the wood, give them the photograph, and they'd match it. It was great. But all of a sudden, they stopped processing that film because the computer had come along. And the other change was that I would go and I'd have a transparency, 35 millimeter transparency. And this place would give me duplicates that were every bit as good as the original. And if I wanted to get my work in a magazine, I would send them all the information and the transparency. The next thing I know, they said, well, send us a disc. A disc? What are you talking about? Well, everybody knows what that is. No, just send us a disc and we'll consider it. So all of a sudden, the camera that I had learned to use by merely trial and error over a long period of time was obsolete. But just before that, I was using a camera, and when I take it to the processors, they could never seem to get it centered in the frame the way I wanted it. And I realized, I went to the photographers and they said, well, the camera you have is only seeing, when you look through the aperture, you're only seeing about 87% of what the lens sees. And so your eye is not able to do it. What you need to do, Cummings, is get yourself a better camera. So I said, okay. And he said, well, and by the way, if you want really good photographs, you should go to a larger format. I said, okay. All of a sudden, we're talking big dollars for the camera. And then to control everything, I needed to move inside. I lost the piece because I was photographing outside in that wonderful sunlight. But a gust of wind came over. That piece was never seen. I have a photograph of it though, but it was destroyed. So I needed to move inside. Then I just thought, well, wait a minute. I am now starting to spend a great deal of money on cameras, film. You're talking about going to larger format. I don't want to be a photographer. That's not what I want to do. I want to work in the studio. And that's when I decided, well, maybe you should start paying a photographer to do this. And then, well, I ran into this photographer who had wonderful ideas about what they wanted that picture to look like, but it wasn't what I wanted. I just want a clean, sharp image. I don't want a fancy background. Just focus on the work. But if we do this, if we put reflectors over here, we can do this. No, don't want to do that. So I learned how to take photographs. I still take a few, but I did have to finally move to a new camera, which is the new format. I don't like it at all. It's a computer. There's no film in that camera. And my brain just not able to connect with that camera. Like I can't connect with a computer, and I'm having trouble with the television now. But my brain is wired differently. And that's not a good thing or a bad thing, it just is. And I'm having trouble getting used to it. I get so frustrated when I'm trying to work on a computer and it doesn't do what I want it to do. And I know it can do it, but I just don't know how to make the camera do it. So I'm constantly calling my son or one of his friends, Jim, his name, come on, Jim. And by the time I call Jim, I'm ready to let it go. No, that's not right. I'm ready to destroy things.
I wanted to ask one more question,
sure.
Which is, I don't know if I'll use the answer or not, but okay. It's really for my own personal interest. And that is this. Have you, in the course of the show while you've been here, seen a person come in, look at your work, and start to get all weepy because they are wood turners? And what you're doing is showing them something that they will never, in their wildest fevered imaginings, be able to accomplish.
Yeah. Not really, in this case. It's better than that. What I mean by better than that, I've had people come into this gallery, and if I'm off to the side, I can't be close to them. Because if I'm close to the person and they know I can hear them, their response to the work is different because I can hear it. What I want to hear is how they feel when they think I'm not there. Like I mentioned before, this installation is a love story. So I've heard in this gallery people saying, I wish somebody felt that way about me. Doesn't get any better than that. What that means is that I was successful in communicating the essence of what the work was about. I haven't talked to any woodworkers, furniture makers, or wood turners here. But I have earlier, and they would say things, you know, they would preface their statements with, I'm just a beginner, or I haven't been doing it long yet. I just do it as a hobby. I've heard those statements prior to them talking. Which is okay, because it gives me a better idea of what my approach to them should be. Because I realize that it's taken me 40 years to do that. I'd say 40 plus 4.
I'm going to stop for 1 second.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When I was a brand new instructor, at Long Beach State, which was one of the most exciting times of my life, to be able to teach at a university. When you look at my transcripts and my background, you know, that was just not in the cards. But once I was there and I became more of a colleague with some of my colleagues, we used to discuss things over coffee or at lunch or something like that. And one of the topics at one time was, what is art? Which is kind of a trick question, because there's no real one answer to that. But I remember talking to some graphic designers, some painters, industrial designers, and they were talking about something. And I had decided that I don't have an answer to what is real art. But I know when I'm around it. When you're around really what I call grandmaster art, and we're talking about the Sistine Chapel, the Pietà by Michelangelo, those really great works, there are usually three responses, three different responses. The first response, or I put them in this order, I usually say the last one. The first response is usually the last one I'm talking about. But the first response is, well, my God, how in the hell did he do that? I call that technical prowess. I've seen it in all kinds of things. I've seen model trains. But I said, oh my God, how in the hell did they do that? It is so wonderful, so accurate, that it's mind-boggling. I cannot figure out how anybody could do that. With my work, there's another response. Wow, what is that? What kind of material is that? And I hear that a lot in this room over here. People assume that there's a piece over there, they assume that must be ivory. Because it's white. But it's not, it's wood. But it's been bleached. There's a piece in here, this one right here, that oh no, that's gotta be metal. Because you could cast that and do all these things. So that's technical prowess. The third response is the one that I strive for in all my work. And that response is in silence. It's the kind of response that you have if you're ever lucky enough to be in the room with Michelangelo's Pietà. It could be 50 or 100 people in there, but you'll be able to hear a pin drop. It's absolute silence. It leaves the person, pour back a little bit. One of the major pieces that I've accomplished that's had the most success was a piece that was heavily criticized by my colleagues. And my goal, rephrase that, the piece I had done up to this last piece that I'm talking about was criticized by my colleagues. And my goal was to stop the criticism, leave them without anything to say, or to leave them speechless. That was a conscious goal and something I've thought about for years and years. How do you do that? How do you make a piece that leaves a person speechless? So that's an issue with every piece I do. What materials can you use that assist in that effort? One of the things that there are several things that has to happen in order to leave a person speechless. If you have a room full of objects, the first thing you have to do is get their attention. If you have 50 objects in a room, how do you get them to ignore the 50 or ignore the 49 in your work? How do you do that? That has been a question in my mind for many, many, many years. And I have some answers to that. You just have to understand how the eye works, how the eye and the brain works. Things that get attention. If you have a room full of, let's say, basketball-sized objects, and then there's a beach ball in there, the beach ball will get their attention because it's out of place. It draws your attention because it's larger than everything else. So if you do something that's larger than anything else, it tends, it's not an exact science, but it tends to get their attention. If you do something that is shiny, that tends to work. In terms of color, if you use colors that are high contrast, that will do it also. And if you take the entire color spectrum and you pick any two colors that are opposite each other on the color wheel, they will get your attention much more so than almost any other combination, because those colors clash. They fight. If you look at them, it's hard to look at the line where they come together. In fact, there's a fuzzy line because they fight each other. So those are ways of doing it. So one of my goals is to, first of all, get your attention. But once I get your attention, my goal is to leave you speechless. And most of them are successful. After the initial shock of seeing the piece, because most people are shocked, like, what? And usually the first question that will pop up will be, well, how do you do that? But it comes up a little while. It takes them a while to figure out what they want to say about the piece. And the first one is usually, how did you do that? Now the how part, at first I was reluctant to talk about that, because it was like, it's like finding out where the rabbit is when you go to a magic show. See, if you know where the rabbit is, what's the point of paying for the ticket? There's no point in going if you know. So part of it is the mystique, the mystery is part of it. I am reluctant to give that information out to woodworkers and wood turners, because their goal is to reproduce it or to make something like it. And in all the years that I have taught, I've never talked about my own work. Unless it's a graduate level course, and I'll do it at the end of the semester. But I'm much more interested in teaching my students how to find their own magic. That to me is much more exciting than telling them my magic. By letting a student, I got a letter from a student. I was very proud to be given the Outstanding Professor Award at Cal State Fullerton. And to get that, I had lots of letters from other students. And one of the letters, which is one of my favorite, is, thank you, Mr. Cummings, for not giving us the answer. Now, what that means is there are certain things that I will tell a student without question, but then there are certain things I won't tell them because I realize the process of discovering the answer is more important than the answer. And I want you to take that journey. And I want to stand back here and watch you do it because you're taking a journey that I would not take. That way we'll both learn. So, I am always pleased and honored when I get that kind of response. Because the critical point, or the critical part of the creative process is when the audience makes their contribution to the creative process. It's only then that it's complete. So when the audience comes in and applauds, then you did a good job. But if they look at it, oh, that's nice, and walk out the door, it means go back to work. So how people respond is critical to the success of my work. I look forward to getting the piece finished and having the response. There are pieces that I've done that were designed to get a response from one person, and that response often was just a smile. It wasn't words. And when I see that smile, I'm like, yes, I did it.
I do have one question about that. Don't you think, though, that sometimes, like when you were talking about the criticism that you're getting about some of your work, don't you think sometimes that the when people are behaving in that way, it doesn't really have anything to do with the work itself, that it's an ideological or a fashion or that it's something about, it's something that they're bringing, the work can stand.
You're absolutely right. You know, I now know that that was the case. I didn't understand it then. I was very new at it. I was in an environment where I thought people respected it, and then come to find out that they didn't, was extremely painful. But at the same time, it was that pain and that frustration that drove me to do the piece that really, really set it off. So if it had not been for that, and I do realize that the reason for them saying that had absolutely nothing to do with the work itself. So I'm really glad it happened because of what came out of it. But the idea is still relevant. So whatever the rationale is for making the criticism, something inside me wants to address it. And I realized that you can't address it with words. Having a conversation with those kinds of individuals is a waste of time. You can't change those. But I still want to give it a shot. Something says, yeah, I'll give it a shot.
Well,
it won't hurt.
Well, I have to say that the show is beautiful. It felt, the moment I walked in, it felt so good to be in the same room with your work. And when I saw the clock, I didn't even know when I got it, came here, that you had done another clock. And when I came in and saw it, I nearly fell over. I was so happy to see that you had stepped up to that plate again. I know that it was probably a difficult decision to make. But, I know that it's impossible for a person standing in front of this thing to really fully understand the scope of its ideation. Not even the execution, but the ideation. And it's just such a privilege and a pleasure to have it here. and that you're sharing it with the community. So thank you for that very much.
Thank you.